Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Latino Vote Podcast. My name is Chuck Roach, and we'll be joined here in just a second from my brother from another mother, Mike Madrid. We are less than one day from the election. You're going to be hearing this podcast the day before the election. I'm coming to you live from the glassed, enclosed Latino Vote Podcast headquarters directly from a food court in Northwest D.C. We are super happy to be with you. Mike, where in the heck are you at?
I'm down in Mexico right now, which is usually, it's about a week earlier than I usually head down. Normally, I head down the day after elections. But because I am not in the saddle for the first time in 30 years of a major campaign the way that I have been every election cycle, I decided to come down a little bit earlier so I could spend more time doing more of the analysis and taking interviews from down here. So I'm excited to be down in what will become a vacation spot a week from now, but for the moment remains kind of a better workplace than I think most people get the opportunity to that are still doing campaigns. I'm excited to introduce and talk about our next guest for a couple of reasons, a whole lot of reasons. The main one being a lot of our listeners, one of the fundamental foundational questions that we ask about Latino voters is who is Latino, what Latino means. There's obviously cultural and social questions related to that. But as a practical matter, the second part of the name of our title is the Latino vote. The Latino voter is what we're focused on. Both Chuck and I have been doing this for many, many decades, and we both rely on one outfit nationally to give us the answer as to who these voters are and everything that is discernible about these voters. And it comes from us from a data company by the name of L2. Now, anybody who has worked in the political professional space has heard of L2. Their voter data is second to none. They're, if not the largest, they're one of the largest data vendors in the country. And it's kind of like being in the soft drink business and not knowing what Coca-Cola is for non-campaign professionals. But I know most of the campaign pros that listen to us either use L2 data or should be using L2 data. We're going to talk about some of what it means to be a Latino on the voter file, but there's so much more just a week out to talk to data vendors about right now. And we're going to dig into a lot of that this episode. One of the really good parts of L2 are the people that we get to work with. And the executive vice president of L2 is a gentleman by the name of Paul Westcott. And Paul has extensive experience in working with media before coming to the data field and the data space. I don't know how long he's been doing the numbers side of things in politics, but I do want to get some of that background. And without further ado, Paul, we're just going to go ahead and start jumping in. I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself and L2, but then we're going to geek out a little bit and get into some of what you are seeing out there as one of the, if not the largest data vendors politically in the country. So can I just go ahead and take that and drop that over to you right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for having me. And, you know, I have to say, you know, when it comes to, you know, L2, the company itself, I've been with L2 almost 9 years now, which sounds like a long time. But in the history of L2, it's been around since 1970. So we started as labels and lists over 50 years ago. And it started off with a simple idea, which is voter file data is great. It gives you a lot of rich baseline information, but it needs to be cleaned up. It needs to have additional fields added to it. There needs to be other pieces to it as well. And that's kind of where labels and lists and now L2 came from. And it started just in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State, expanded to California, and then nationwide after that.
Well, I was thinking about it and jumping in on you, Mike, is that I think some folks need to know that with L2, the L2 is in partnerships with the Latino Vote Podcast now. We're super happy to have that partnership. And what really brings L2 to be different than most other data firms, which is important for this particular podcast, and it's important for you folks to know, and this is the reason why Paul is here, is that they sell data to Democrats and they sell data to Republicans. They sell data to independents. They sell data to organizations. They sell data to folks who want to buy data, and they stay out of, we're just a Democratic data or just a Republican data firm. That's why I think this conversation today is so interesting, and why I wanted to have Paul here is he's uniquely positioned, like me and Mike Madrid. Obviously, you know that I'm the better looking Democrat here, and Mike's an old, ugly Republican, but we wanted somebody here who was selling data to both parties who could kind of give us something, a look behind the curtain, as we realize, as you're listening to this podcast, that tomorrow again is election day, because we're dropping this podcast on Monday before the election. Paul, as Mike was mentioning, you get to see lots of data coming in and out, folks requesting data. You get to see the early vote numbers. I assume every day from secretaries of states around the country, you get to get, because we look at your data and see who's already voted, because I want to take out people who have already voted when I'm doing mail, and especially these last minute phone calls. From the data that you're seeing from the secretary of states that show at least partisan registration, what are you seeing with Latinos now in probably some of the most pivotal states, maybe Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Georgia?
Absolutely. So we're looking at this year, 41 different states that are doing some kind of early voting. Now that's compared to the last midterm where we were bringing in around 13 or 14 states. So to show you the difference, a few years and a global pandemic make to voting. But looking at some of that early return data nationwide from those 41 states, what we're looking at is approximately 12.6% of those voters are Hispanic. It looks like 8.4%, of the early voters, 8.4% are Hispanic. Now that's nationwide among the whole group. Looking at Pennsylvania, 5.5% Hispanic, 21% in Nevada, and 5.8% in Georgia. So some large numbers when you're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands and over a million voters in some cases voting in these states.
And so when you think about, you know, you've talked about being at L2 for a long time, and we've mm-hmm. also talked about peaks and valleys of early vote in 2020, early vote in 2018. How do you think this stacks up from years past?
I mean, it's hard to compare. I see a lot of comparisons where people are saying, oh, there's early voting here, early voting there. You know, as an overall percentage, I mean, I think it's the overall percentage or raw numbers. You're just going to see a huge jump just because this is a year where so many more states have started to make early voting or mail-in voting part of the norm. So we are seeing a huge lift. But of those states that previously had done early voting, I would say this is about on par with a midterm year. And, you know, as you know, Mike knows so well, and you know so well, in California, obviously early voting has gone on for a very long time, and it's looking about standard for California midterm turnout. But when you're talking about some of these other states that are somewhat new to it, including Pennsylvania, even Georgia to in some extent, the turnout actually looks pretty good, pretty solid in terms of the early voter turnout.
The last question I would have is, as in 2020, there were all these COVID things that helped people vote. There was places you could vote by mail earlier or quicker, like they were drop-off ballots in Texas. Now that some of that's been rolled back because we're not in the age of COVID, have you seen that affecting the numbers from state to state?
You know, in some cases, yes, but in a lot of cases, it's sort of like unringing a bell or putting the toothpaste back in the tube or whatever analogy you want to use. It's kind of hard to undo it once people get the understanding of, oh, I can send in a mail-in ballot. Isn't that easy? Isn't that nice? The places where we're seeing the biggest rollbacks will be those states where, you know, you have to essentially register each year that you want to vote early. And so that's where you're going to see that big difference, whereas states pretty much got rid of those regulations. They just sent ballots to anybody who could possibly get them. But in this case, I think, you know, this year, I think even with the rollbacks in those states, I think you're going to see record numbers of early turnout. We've already, you know, surpassed 2018, and we'll see what happens on election day here. But we've already surpassed 2018 in terms of early voting.
Paul, have you seen in your career at L2 from the beginning till now more people wanting more data on our voters, this Latino Hispanic group?
Absolutely. And it's not only, you know, can we define, because we have several different categorizations of Latino voters. It starts with what we call this sort of broad group of Hispanic and Portuguese, right? It's, so it's this kind of very broad ethnic categorization. We have it for East and South Asian. We have it for what we call European or white voters and African American voters. And then it goes in, then we go to subcategorizations of each of those groups, including for Hispanic voters, we have country of origin, which, as you know, is so critical because there's a difference between a Mexican voter, a Cuban voter, and, you know, a Venezuelan voter. So there are a lot of different breakouts that we're able to incorporate into the data. And I would say in the last two cycles, we've seen, and that includes 18 as well, that includes a lot of interest in terms of breaking down in a more granular way, sort of the Hispanic electorate, the Latino electorate, and not just by that, but also by things like, age groups and breaking out, you know, this electorate, because it's so large, so substantial, and people are seeing the turnout. They're doing the same kind of sort of micro targeting that they'd be doing of the electorate as a whole or white voters as a whole, for Latino voters. And it's been fascinating to see some of the different breakdowns, as opposed to in the, you know, in years past where we would say, oh, I want white voters, I want black voters, I want Latino voters. Now it's very much more, I want to break down each of these groups by other additional subgroups. And we're seeing that with Latino voters almost more than anything.
So I want to talk about setting people's stages for what will happen after the election when it comes to that. And I think it's important for you to explain that to folks is we're going to see on election day, we will know everyone who early voted. Now, Paul can look at the data and tell you if it's a state that has partisan registration where you claim a party, he can say Chuck Rocha, registered Democrat, early voted in Washington, D.C. And that, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, has happened this week. But in certain states like Texas, there's not a partisan registration. So what Paul and other data companies do is they model voters based off of where they live, what primaries they vote in. There's lots of things that gives you a pretty good determination. And these models are pretty good on a partisan model. Who is more likely to be a Democrat or Republican? And so they put that in there. When folks on Twitter, mainly between now and tomorrow, because today is the day before the election, I keep reminding everybody, is you're seeing, well, we have this many more early votes than in 2018, or this many more early votes in 2020, this many more women have voted. All interesting numbers and all factually true, because those are people who actually voted. But on election day, when people say, well, did the Latinos win the vote? Did we not win the vote? Where did they turn out? Some of that is a guesstimation off of exit polling, that we can have a whole separate conversation about exit polling. There'll also be election day polling into Latinos, asking them how they voted. But Paul, I think that big Mike Madrid windup is to ask you this question, which is, how long will it take normally? And I know every state is different, but on average, from after election day till we get a file that says we know exactly who voted and exactly who didn't vote on election day, to really dig into those numbers, how long does that normally take?
Yeah. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It does vary, but I would say, you know, on average, we're looking at 2 to 3 months where you're going to get those full certified returns. Now in Texas, you're waiting for, you know, and no offense to Texas, I love Texas, but there are some small counties in Texas where cows outnumber people. And when you're dealing with that population, all of a sudden you're asking the county clerk, who also might be, you know, the county commissioner in that jurisdiction, to turn around their election results. And we essentially at L2 have to make the determination, are we going to wait for that very small county to return its certified ballots while we know we have, you know, 95% of the rest of the state? So that's the big question, is sort of, you know, when those small counties come in. But typically 2 to 3 months, and we'll get that data back.
And I think it's super important for our super nerd listeners who are so hungry to know what happened with this vote, and we'll see a media narrative come out of this election, to know that we're not actually going to know everybody who voted on election day until 3 months later, girls and boys. We'll have a decent idea because of exit polling, a decent idea because of other polling, and there'll be people that will dig into Latino precincts that are 80 or 90% Latino and say that they voted at this percentage, and Mike Madrid will go after them on that. But we really won't know exactly who voted for 3 or 4 months.
You know, the things that are so notable about these voters, and Chuck and Mike, to your points about, you know, individual level voter data versus exit polling or other, you know, precinct level data. Individual level data is really the only way you're going to know these things of who's who in the electorate. And that's how we're able to give you all the information I'm telling you right now. But looking at the Hispanic electorate overall, they tend to be, as I mentioned earlier, younger, so far younger than any of the other demographic cohorts we have broken out, the ethnic groupings that we have broken out, by a lot, by about 20 years, tend to be younger. And they also tend to be more evenly split between men and women, whereas women far outpace men in almost every other demographic category. So, you know, in this world, we're seeing younger men actually voting among Latinos far more so than any other demographic group. So that was something that I definitely thought was interesting. I haven't had a chance to dig into some of the, you know, the income or the other data. Looking at sort of the area selections where these individuals are coming from, they're almost entirely urban areas. And I wouldn't say entirely, excuse me, over 50% urban areas among Latino voters versus white voters, where it's closer to 50% suburban areas. So I would say that's probably one of the other big defining characteristics. But based on, you know, states, the big, you know, turnout states tend to be where you see those larger Latino populations. They're, you know, turning out in larger numbers, like Nevada, like California, Texas, et cetera.
One of the things that I have used L2 data for, and one of the things, I'm very visual. And so L2 has a great mapping tool, Mike. And what I will do a lot of times is you can go in and say, I just want to see on this map Latino voters. And then on this map, I want you to color code the Democratic Latinos as blue and the ones that are registered Republicans as red. And then you can look at a map geographically and see that. Let's take, for example, this Texas 15 district that me and Mike are obsessed about, that starts in McAllen on the Mexican border and goes up like a piece of bacon to the suburbs of San Antonio. If you look at that, you can see almost the more north you get out of the district, the more Republican the district, those red dots become. And then you can see the two media markets different and who the voters are you want to see there. Many times folks just see a list and know that it takes up this much, but that tool of being able to map out voters is a really cool tool that I've used many times to figure out where are the Latinos living and where are those houses situated next to a military base? Where are they situated next to a national forest? So those kind of things are a big part of that. Paul, one of the questions I'd have for you is as we get through this election and we start looking towards 2024, and the presidential election, as me and you both know, will begin the day after this primary is over tomorrow. What are the new things and new technologies that data companies and folks like you are looking towards as you're starting to get ready for probably a very multi-candidate primary in the Republican side? You know, if Joe Biden wins, there probably won't be much opposition, but there'll be these big races getting ready for the Senate immediately. What are some of the new things you're looking at when it comes to that?
Sure. I think, you know, there's a lot of technology out there, obviously, you know, on the digital side, which I can definitely get into. But I think, you know, to your point on visualization, I think we're going to see a lot more use of technology that's been, quite frankly, in practice in the consumer space for a long time. That's not only going to apply to the big races, but also those down ballot races. You know, you're going to see, you know, for the first time this cycle, we saw school boards using our data in creative ways beyond just, hey, I need a mailing list. Hey, I need a walk sheet. This is, I'm actually going to dig into the demographics. I'm going to use the visualization. I'm going to load it into an e-canvasser type platform and go walk against it, things like that. So that's something that we've seen more technology on. Obviously, texting is going to continue to dominate until that gets regulated away, if it ever gets regulated away. But texting has been huge. Obviously, the ability to send videos, GIFs, other things like that. We've seen the data be used heavily for that. And then, you know, the continued growth of analytics and trying to determine, you know, who those voters are more as people and what they care about. You know, there's a big a big piece in The Atlantic talking about, you know, the Latino vote, and particularly talking about how, oh, you know, this meme, this trope that's out there about, you know, I'm sure that you both have discussed a lot, you know, a lot of Latino voters turning Republican. But basically, instead of targeting people by somewhat broader groups, using the underlying L2 data, the voter file information and the demographic data to build out more sophisticated targeting for things that allow you to find people by very specific issues, and then also how to reach people by what channel of communication. So that kind of modeling we've seen both in sort of a broader national way, but also people doing it on a state by state, locality by locality basis. So that's something that I think we're definitely going to see a great deal more of. So if anybody ever wants to reach out, obviously you could just go to our website, l2-data.com, or just Google L2 data and you'll be able to find it. I'm right there on the leadership page. My name and email are all right there. But yeah, just Google L2 data and we'll come up first.
And my closing comment here, Paul, and I appreciate your time today, is that just the other day, I want to give a hat tip to a mutual friend of ours at Haystack DNA, who is a good friend of mine, who worked with me on the Bernie Sanders campaign. And Paul, I don't think I've told you this, but my fiance is running for ANC commissioner here in DC. And so I found the geographical map for her ANC. You obviously can't find any data down to a sub city council district in DC. But because I do this for a living and know the data, me and Andrew Dressler over at Haystack went into L2. We drew a digital map around the boundaries of her ANC commissioner spot. Then we went in and did a map. We overlaid the Democrats and Republicans. There were about 1,600 people, about 890 households. And excuse me, we did a mail program and we called the voters for Ebony, my fiance, for her race is happening tomorrow. She'll be on the ballot. She's been on the ballot. But that's how we used L2 to fit into a local race that I thought you'd be proud to hear here in D.C.
I'm so happy to hear that. That's the kind of thing. Well, hopefully people will start using this for local races who don't happen to have, you know, Chuck Rocha engaged to them, but you know, that's great. I wish her the best of luck on election day.
Thank you, Paul. And we appreciate the partnership with L2. This was a great conversation. We'll be right back after this message. Thank you very much. Well, welcome back to the Latino Vote Podcast. That was a super interesting conversation, Mike. I'm so glad that we got to pull the covers back a little bit on the data conversation, being that tomorrow is election day. But that was really interesting hearing what Paul had to say, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's good to be able to share with viewers some of the more granular stuff about what it is that we do. We also don't want to kind of lose people and lose interest, but I know there's a lot of people who really do love the show that want to talk about the numbers specifically. And I can't underscore just how significant it is or actually is. There's country of origin differentiations. There's age differentiations. There's generational variations. There's interracial marriage rates or differentiations. And vendors like L2 go above and beyond to make sure that they're enhancing the data, adding onto the data as much as they possibly can, but also making sure that the actual core of what a Latino voter is accurate, because you don't want to be out there communicating to non-Latinos with Latino messaging. You certainly don't want to get the Spanish-English dominant variation mixes wrong. And when your reputation is on the line as a campaign consultant and spending those precious resources, you've got to spend them in the right way with a very, very tricky universe. It's guys like Paul at L2 that you are basing your entire company's reputation on, and it's good to kind of have them look under the hood a little bit with viewers to get a better understanding of how we go about doing it.
So tomorrow is election day. I really appreciate everybody who stayed with us on this Latino Vote Podcast. And right now, me and Michael are going to give you some races that you should be looking for tomorrow night. And let me stress that especially in California, we're not going to know who won every race tomorrow night. It may take a few days in places where we have to count absentee ballots for several days. And I'd first caution you on the Pennsylvania Senate race, because how the Pennsylvania state legislature has drawn their rules, they can't start counting ballots until election morning for all these mail-ins. So I remind you that they didn't call Pennsylvania for Joe Biden until the Saturday after the election because it took them that long to count all of these ballots. Now, have they gotten better at it? Yes. Should there be less ballots because of COVID? Yes. But we will not know unless there's a blowout, which will be a surprise, who wins the Pennsylvania Senate race. So just know that will take a while. If you were to say, well, Chuck, what races do I look at to determine what's going to happen in the first few hours? Pay attention to North Carolina, which is an early East Coast state, especially the new congressional district, the 13th. Like whoever wins that district, it may be the 16th. I'll have to pull it up. But that new CD in North Carolina and Rhode Island 2, which is a new CD that's been gerrymandered to be almost a 50-50 seat. So that Rhode Island congressional seat, the North Carolina Senate seat, the North Carolina 16 CD, those are early in the night things that will give you a good indication of how the night's going to go for Democrats and Republicans. And then I would sprinkle in also that Florida will be an early predictor, but it's kind of skewed because there really wasn't any marginal races there except for Florida 27. I draw your attention to Florida 27 because it's literally the last 50-50 seat in Florida. And you have two powerhouses, Annette Tadeo against a Republican Latina incumbent in a seat that was redrawn to be 50-50. So on election night, Mike, what else will you be looking at early besides those things?
Well, look, I think you set this up perfectly. So let me say this again, because I want to underscore how important it is. And part of protecting and preserving democracy and voting is maintaining integrity in that process. The more ways we allow people to vote, which is a good thing, by the way, the longer it's going to take to get the results of the election. We cannot allow that vulnerable period in democracy to be used to undermine election integrity. And in places like California, where there are going to be a handful of seats that I'll walk through right now that are going to take weeks, not just days, weeks to actually figure out who actually won these, we're going to have to caution and counsel patience. But I want to double down. North Carolina is going to tell us a lot. It's going to tell us a lot early. Okay. The margin between that Senate race that's going on right now, and if you see Democrats popping up above water and hanging on there, could be a really good night for Democrats. If it's in contention, probably means it's going to be a long nail biter, and a lot of races are going to go both ways, and it's going to be much closer. If you start to see that Republican lead open up widely, I think you can safely say that you could be seeing the early signs of a pretty good Republican surge. Okay, those important key indicators, big, big important. North Carolina, I think, is probably the best indicator to look at. The next thing I'm looking at is the margins in the Michigan governor's race, the Ross Johnson Mandela Barnes Senate race in Wisconsin, and then the margin in Iowa. Those are the next big, big races that you'll get a good sense of what is coming in on. We're not going to know in Georgia exactly what the outcome is going to be with complete confidence. I would suggest for probably 3 days, 4 days, because the Warnock-Walker race is going to be so close, just like it was with Biden and Trump. It's going to come down to counting in Gwinnett and DeKalb counties outside of Atlanta. We're going to see this race come to within 50,000 votes, probably maybe less than 70 to 50,000 votes. That means it's going to take some time to process and count those. We are not going to know election night. We need to be very careful of what that means. We're looking for marginal indicators. Rolling into California, I think it's really important. Look at the California 22 race, David Valadao, one of the most contentious seats nationally, rural, very Hispanic, Latino vote will be decisive. Mike Garcia, Republican incumbent, whether or not he holds on to that seat in a suburban area where Latinos don't compromise a lot of suburban voters in most parts of the country, this is one spot where they do and will be determinative. Mike Garcia has won the suburban Hispanic Hispanic vote before. The question is, will he do it again? It's going to take a very long time to count because it's Los Angeles County, the slowest counting county in America. And then I want you to take a good close look at California 13. John Duarte, Republican, against Adam Gray in a new seat that is extremely contentious. Republicans have shared data with me that they think they're going to get over 50% of the Hispanic vote. Not sure if that's actually true or not, but what I will say is it's going to be close. This one we will know within a matter of days. All of these are going to be big, big signs of which way not only the country goes, but where the direction of the Hispanic vote is going, this Latino vote that is going to decide the control of Congress and the balance of power for the next decade and beyond. Keep focus on those races because they're going to tell us everything we need to know about where this country is heading.
So I want to dive in here on a group of races. And the first group of races that I want to bring to your attention is races you can look at on election night to see how did the Latino vote go. So the first six races I want to mention all have one thing in common, and that means they are all marginal congressional races, somewhat marginal, that all have more than 50% Latino population. That means they are majority Latino population, big, big Latino races. And we start with the first three that are in Texas, the three that me and Mike Madrid have been talking about. That's Texas 15, Texas 28, Texas 34. That's where incumbent Henry Cuellar is running, incumbent Vicente Gonzalez is running, and where there's an open seat in the 15th where Michelle Vallejo is running against Monica De La Cruz. And then the next three, I just mentioned Florida 27 in Miami. Mike mentioned California 22 and New Mexico 2, which we haven't mentioned today, but we've talked about before, which is the southern part of New Mexico. So all six of those races, boys and girls, all over 50% Latino. For God's sakes, the top four, those three Texas seats and that one Florida seat, are all over 65% Latino, and the Texas seats are all over 70% Latino. But this part of the conversation is really important for you because you can't measure them all the same. Texas 34 is a D plus 14 seat that we are now talking about being marginal. Why in the hell is a D plus 14 seat even on the map to be marginal? He's running against Myra Flores, who won in a special election. Keep it in mind, on election night, tomorrow night, D plus 14. The 28th, Henry Cuellar, is a D plus 7 seat. When me and Mike Madrid both had hair and were skinny, both of those seats would have been safe as hell. We would have never spent money even in a D plus 7 seat. That would have been a great seat. Now, Texas 15 is an R plus 2 seat, Republican plus 2. The Florida 27 seat is even, dead even, Democrat, Republican. California 22, Mike, is a D plus 9 seat that is now considered marginal. Why is a D plus? Because Valadao does a really good job. Mike will probably explain in a minute by getting Latinos to vote for him. And then New Mexico 1 is a D plus 1 seat because they added 100,000 South Albuquerque Democrats to this CD to make it competitive. It used to be an R plus 3. Now it's New Mexico is a D plus 1. Mike, you want to comment on any of those seats?
I want to use another way to look at this, folks, is most of these districts are very rural. Not all of them, but most of them. Yeah, they tend to be very rural seats. And the commonality, one of the real important threads we're going to be looking for, us and probably 25 other Latino journalists and academics and pundits, many of whom have been on the podcast over the course of the past couple of months, we're looking for these commonalities and these threads to start telling us about what the future is going to hold. It's really important that when Chuck points out these six seats, at least five of the six of them are very rural agricultural seats, more poor, non-college educated, working class voters. That's this Latino voter that we've been talking about that has been showing this rightward shift. You're not seeing as much in the urban core because, first of all, they're harder to draw competitive districts with Latinos because Latinos tend to be very dominant, very dense in these areas. But that's a really important point to take a look at, is these are rural communities. They tend to be culturally conservative. They tend to be oftentimes, especially in Texas, these longer generational experiences where some families have been there, maybe not just recently migrated like the Myra Flores is, but have had families in these parts for four, five, six generations. Okay, all of these threads, which have been kind of these unique, nuanced parts of the Latino electorate, are now going to become a commonplace part of the narrative after November when the journalists and the political pundits start to say, hey, wait a second, this really matters, because these six seats are not just in contention now. They're going to be competitive, hyper-competitive for the next 10 years at least. So think about that. Whichever party wants to pick up these six seats is going to have a message and an operation and a tactical infrastructure to actually move the needle with this Latino demographic in a way that it probably does not now. So keep that in mind. The Democrats are going to have to figure out a better way to communicate here. The Republicans are going to have to figure out a better way to communicate here. And these first elections, this first stab at these new lines, races in these new lines, is the starting point on what is going to be a very contentious part of the electorate for the next 10 years.
I got two more groups of races I want to quickly move through. The next group of races are all still above 20% Latino population. And I think Mike will see what they have in common as I start going through them really quickly. I won't go into the detail I did on the top six. But the next one is California 9. That'll make Mike laugh because now Josh Harder is running in a new district that is, I swear, Mike, it's a D plus five seat. We'll get into that. Colorado 8 is a new seat. Again, Northern Denver suburbs. And then the three congressional seats around Las Vegas in Nevada are all up for grabs. The Democrats in Nevada made all three of the seats around Las Vegas more Democratic by taking Democrats out of that super Democratic seat in the downtown of Las Vegas. And guess what, Mike? Now all three of them are in jeopardy because of the Latino population being split into three different CDs. And then the last couple are another California seat, which is 45, which is where Jay Chin is running against Michael Steele, an incumbent, D plus two. And then you have California 49, which is where Mike Levin is running against Brian Marriott. And then a couple of surprises here. Both these last couple have about between 12 and 18% Latino population. New York 2, which is an R plus 3. Illinois 14, which is a D plus 4, which is the incumbent Lauren Underwood. And then my favorite one of these is Pennsylvania 7, which is Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton, which is where I've been talking to you about these new Puerto Ricans in eastern Pennsylvania that is now 14% Latino. It's a R plus two seat, and both parties have spent, Mike, over $4 million on Philly media trying to keep this seat in the hands of Susan Wild. What is your thought about these?
So this is really fascinating. And again, we're getting into some really granular stuff here. Not all, but most of these seats are moving from the rural parts in that first tier Chuck was talking about to now working class, a little bit more exurban, even suburban communities. Really important demographic stratification to take a really good look at and understanding the differences here. Now, it's not all of them, but it's most of them. And here's what's really fascinating, especially those Las Vegas seats. Chuck is 100% right. They moved it from one super concentrated D districts, spread the Democrats out kind of thin in three seats. But, and again, I know this isn't fun to look at, but at the end of this decade, I'm convinced you're going to see three strongly Democratic districts because of the demographic change that's moving into these areas. If Democrats can keep a 65-35 split, 65 Democrat, 35 Republican. There's some conflicting data coming out of Nevada right now. We're going to have to really watch this race on election night. If Cortez Masto wins this race by the historical Democratic trend line of about 65-35 or better, 70-30 for the Democrats, 65-35 benefiting the Democrat, you're going to see her win that race. If she does not, it's a game changer. The Republicans start saying, we've got the advantage. We don't need to win a majority of the Latino vote. We just need to get these same types of margins. It's not California. It's not Arizona. It's a whole new ball game, and we're here to play. But again, those three districts, as 50-50 as they are right now, most data would suggest that every election cycle, they're going to get bluer. They're going to move into a stronger Democratic position. The question is, how quick, how fast? The answers in the margins, as I've been saying all year long, history and campaigns are made and won on the margins. Nevada is ground zero. The focus of that second tier that Chuck is talking about is working class, exurban, suburban, much different than that rural first tier that we're looking at. Keep that in mind as we look at the growth of Latino voters over the course of the next decade.
So the next list I want to talk about is where Latinos, and these are going to be Republicans and Democrats, may win seats that are truly marginal that you wouldn't think about Latinos winning, that nobody's talking about. You'll only hear about that here on the Latino Vote podcast. Let's start with the three Republicans. One of those seats is in Arizona 6. It's a seat, Mike, that's based around Tucson, that goes all around the suburbs around Tucson. And it is a, it's an R+2. It's a marginal seat. Well, this is a seat where the DCCC and House Majority PAC has walked away. They're going to give this seat up to a Republican Latino. His name is Juan Ciscomani. And Juan is going to be a new Republican congressman from Arizona. What? So again, we're losing the narrative battle there. The next seat, this is going to blow y'all's mind, is in Portland, Oregon. It's Mike, the old Kurt Schrader seat, who was the founder of the Blue Dogs. It's the suburbs of Portland, Oregon. It is a D+2 seat, and the Democrats have given up on this seat, and they're going to elect a Latina to this Oregon seat named Lori Chavez de Remer. So it's a Latina who's married a white guy. There's going to be a Latina Republican representing the Oregon's 5th district that Kirk Schrader used to represent. The Democrats up there beat Kirk Schrader in a primary, and this very progressive left-wing Democrat is running there. She still may win, but everybody's saying that this Republican is going to be there. And then the last one, which is my favorite, is this Virginia 7 race where Abigail Spanberger is taking on this woman who we talked about in the last one, which is a woman from El Salvador who's a former sheriff named Yesley Vega is running against Spanberger. Many folks don't think she can beat Spanberger, but Mike, this district is newly drawn. Spanberger has only represented about 40% of this district. It's a D+2 in Virginia. What are your thoughts on these Republican races before I get to the Democrats?
I love the way you've cut these up, Chuck. This is exactly the way a brilliant strategist thinks. These are, like you're saying, these are suburban seats. Now we're moving into suburbia. That's where the future of the Republican Party is largely going to be. This is what Mike Madrid has been saying. If you start getting deep into second and third generation Hispanics, you start seeing people coming from law enforcement backgrounds, professional backgrounds, college educated backgrounds, and they're putting some of these diversifying suburbs into contention. Not a lot of them at this point in time, because Latinos, as was just pointed out by Paul Westcott, we tend to be a very rural or a very urban constituency. We're just now starting to move into these suburbs and fielding more and more candidates. So the main characteristics of those three seats is suburban, different than the previous two sets. What do you got with the Democrat seats that you're looking at last, Joe?
So interestingly enough, right next to that Oregon seat is the Oregon 6th seat, where this amazing Democratic Latina named Andrea Salinas. I remember and remind everybody, this is where the crypto guys spent like $8 million against this Latina, and she beat them. And she beat like 5 other people in this big open primary for this brand new seat. And for all of you super nerds, this is the last seat that was given to a state to expand the map. So Oregon got the last seat to where they got an additional seat that many will know was stolen from Texas because of how Texas in the census didn't count all of the Latinos. So because of how Donald Trump did the census and not really making it accessible, Texas undercounted their Latinos and Oregon got that seat. But I digress. Watch Andrea Salinas. This should be a slam dunk for Democrats. It is a D+6 seat. But again, this week, the DCCC and House Majority PAC has had to dump $1 million into this seat. If she don't win, it's going to be a big upset. She's running against a guy named Mike Erickson. The second and last marginal Latino seat that you won't think of, stay with me, boys and girls, is in Nebraska. Nebraska, too, has got a Latino running there. I didn't write his name down. It's Juan. Juan, I'll pull it up in a minute. But Juan is running Juan Vargas, for God's sakes, in a seat that is a 50-50 seat in Nebraska 2. They made Nebraska 2 more Democratic, because the other seat there, they wanted to make less, so they moved some seats over. So those are the two Democratic opportunities to win seats that don't have huge populations. And then I would be remiss, because we've talked about all the surge with Republicans. We're not talking enough about there's going to be more Democratic Latinos just because of our growth in Congress after tomorrow night's election. And I'll quickly mention Greg Kassar is going to be a congressman from Austin. Delia Ramirez is going to be a congresswoman from Chicago. Maxwell Frost is going to be a congressman from Orlando. And Robert Garcia is going to be a congressman from Long Beach. So before there's even any marginal seats talked about, Democrats add four new members because of the seat growth and the growth of our population that we all talk about, which is historically Democratic. But there are these opportunities on both sides, Mike.
And let's talk about that, because this is what's so important. No matter what happens, no matter what happens on election night, tomorrow night, the whole narrative of what a Latino means and what it is going to explode. It's going to shatter. Let me explain why. You look at Malcolm Frost, Afro-Cuban young man. This guy is going to redefine what it means to be Cuban politically in Florida. Okay? He looks different. He believes different. He's from a new generation. He's not your grandfather's Cuban Republican. Robert Garcia will be one of the strongest LGBTQ voices in the entire Congress. He has already redefined that experience in conjunction with his Latinidad. He's going to continue to do that on a national stage. And as Chuck pointed out, not only will there be four new faces in the Hispanic Democratic caucus, you're going to start seeing more Mexican-American faces in the Republican conference as well. And that's going to challenge the narrative of Republican white exclusivity. And it's also going to force us to focus on Latino issues from a policy perspective in a way that is unique for both Democrats and Republicans. So this is at the minimum. This is before we start to look at some of these really cool underlying trends. At a minimum, the entire stereotype of Hispanicity and the Latino vote is going to dramatically change in one night.
So think about that. What Mike just said is that after the election is all counted tomorrow night, you're going to at least have four, if not six, new Democratic Latino members. Let's call it, in my guesstimation, looking at the polls right now, six new Latino members of the Democratic caucus that are Latino. And my guesstimation says that there's at least three, if not four, new Republican Latinos. That may be more new Latino Republicans that have ever been elected to Congress. And to Mike's point, you're talking about electing truly conservative, crazy, in my opinion, Latinas like Monica de la Cruz, who will probably win in Texas 15. I hope she doesn't. And then Maxwell Frost, the absolute opposite end of the spectrum, all serving together in Congress, where now there's going to be a debate of who is our community, because there'll be more Latinos in Congress than have ever been in Congress before from both parties. The Republican Latinos that now are like 8 or 9 will end up being 14 or 15. Democrats that are at 38 now will probably be at 41, 42, our voice will be more diverse. It'll have every ideological background. And guess what, girls and boys? Actually, just like the voters all across America that are Latino, that are becoming of age, as Mike Madrid has said, we represent every aspect of this. We've all had a crazy right-wing uncle. We've all had a crazy left-wing kid or left-wing person like me in their life. They don't have to be a kid. They can be an old left-winger like me as well. But that's who the party is. The party is Mike Madrid and Chuck Rocha, Myra Macias, Sabrina Rodriguez, Adrian Carrasquillo, all these people that we've talked to on this podcast from all these different countries, from all these ideological backgrounds. That's who we are, right, Mike?
That's who we are. That's the story of what's unfolding in America. We're going to be there narrating it the entire way, by the way. This is the last taping recording of the Latino Vote podcast for the 2022 election cycle. But know this, is the first podcast of the brave new world we are entering. It only gets bigger and better from here on out, folks. Chuck and I will be there to explore it with you every step of the way. We'll be bringing you the data, the polling, the precinct results, along with those that are writing the unfolding story of the Latino vote, the top journalists, the top opinion leaders, the top policymakers. Expect a lot of these people, a lot of the people that we've just been talking about, the races that we've been following, to be guests on this show to talk about what is happening and unfolding in this country in real time. It's been such an honor to be with you, Chuck, talking about this. I think that this podcast has not only been successful beyond our wildest imaginations, but it's really established itself as a conversation point, a place where people are looking for this, exactly this discussion. And I have just enjoyed the hell out of being with you every step of the way on this 2022 journey, my brother.
There's two things that we need to think about as we conclude today's podcast is, this is the last episode before the election tomorrow. Me and Mike Madrid are going to be the ones who are going to bring the narrative to the community right after the election to go through just the hard numbers, no spin. This is what you, the audience, should understand. And while we need you back, that next episode probably will end up being too big for one episode. And we'll probably do two or three episodes after the election to go through a couple things. One will be how much money was spent in Spanish, talking to our community by race, and how does that look towards who actually won? Talk about the Latino vote, and how did it actually perform realistically? Was it a big impact in Nevada? Did we win Nevada? Did we lose Nevada? So the post-election part of this, starting next week when we record our episode, will be absolutely huge. Kenna, one of our producers, just sent me some quick tidbits just so you know of things we're looking at, because I had her pull these numbers when we started the episode today. And Mike, I wanted you to know that just as one thing to look at as we're looking at post past tomorrow, Spanish language spending in a place like Arizona in just the Senate race, get this, Democrats spent $10 million on Spanish language advertising in Arizona alone, while Republicans spent $1.5 million on Spanish language advertising. If Mark Kelly wins that race, it will be because of this. If Mark Kelly loses that race and Democrats spent $10 million and still lost, we're going to have a lot to talk about on this podcast. So these are the kind of things that we're going to start bringing you post-election. And Mike, before we get off of this episode, tell us the one thing you're looking at post-election that you're going to be bringing us.
Well, again, there's going to be so much to cover. My guess is we're going to be doing a lot of one-hour episodes, state by state, candidate by candidate, campaign by campaign. We'll be bringing you all the experts who did this work, who were successful. I'm hoping we get people who were not, that are willing to say this is what we should have done and what we saw and what we should have done differently. But the one race that I still remain absolutely focused on is going to be the Nevada Senate race. And the reason why is this. It's large enough of a Latino vote to be absolutely pivotal and determinative of the outcome of the race, one. Two, it's small enough to actually put your teeth and sink your teeth into the actual data and looking at the urban core of Los Angeles, of Las Vegas, but also the suburban periphery that makes out and rounds out Clark County. And three, this is really the question that I'm looking at, Chuck. Is will this Mexican-American vote, and remember, when we're talking about the Latino vote, we're talking about a lot of nationalities. In Las Vegas, we're talking overwhelmingly Mexican-Americans. Will they vote like their California and Arizona brothers and sisters and continue to give Democrats a 75-25 split? Or is it going to act and behave a lot more like the Texas-New Mexico brothers and sisters and start pushing the Hispanic support levels into the mid-30s? That question is not only going to determine the outcome of the Nevada Senate race, it could determine the balance of power in the United States Senate at a pivotal time in American history. But most importantly, it's going to tell us about the future of this vote for at least the next decade and beyond. Eyes on Clark County, folks. Eyes on Latino voters in Nevada. There's going to be a ton of stories to tell. But this one, I think, will be the crown jewel, the daddy, the granddaddy of them all, as they say. And I'm really excited about what we're going to be able to pull out of Nevada.
Do me a favor. If you're listening to this podcast right now, tomorrow is election day. Call everybody in your family. I don't want to see another reporter say that we are underperforming, that we didn't vote. Call everybody you can. Get out that vote. Tomorrow is election day. We have built our careers out of getting people to go vote. It would be remiss on me and Mike Madrid if we didn't tell all of you right now to get out and vote. Call your friends and neighbors. Call your family. I was talking to my son this morning because he works a construction job in Pittsburgh. Go vote. Thank you for listening. Don't forget that tomorrow's election day. We are honored to bring you this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple. Don't forget to share this on your social media. And I can't wait for the post-election episode. I know you can't either. Join us right here on the Latino Vote Podcast. On behalf of Mike Madrid, I'm Chuck Rocha. Thank you for tuning in to the Latino Vote Podcast.